You are about to listen to a sermon preached on the 16th of February 2020 at South Shore Community Church, located on the South Shore of Montreal. Pastor Jay's sermon this week is entitled Science versus Faith.
Well, we're taking just a 1 week break from our series on the fruit of the Spirit today. I like to occasionally intersperse a sermon on an apologetic topic. And that doesn't mean that we'll be apologizing today. Apologetics is when we defend the faith, when we look at some of the questions that we face. And so the series that we're in, I've kind of called Hard Questions, Honest Answers. And we're doing this series because we recognize that there are so many challenges to faith today. Many of them are not new. They've been around for centuries, and yet they kind of keep coming back. And we want to deal with these directly. And one of the challenges, of course, today is in the area of science. And I entitled my message, Science versus Faith, even though I don't actually believe that they're in conflict. But that's kind of how people set it up. The question that people ask, can you actually believe science and be a person of faith as well? Psalm 19, verses 1 to 4 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet, their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the ends of the world." Now, the psalm, of course, is being poetic. And yet, poetry sometimes has tremendous truth for us. The psalm is saying that the world doesn't speak, and yet it speaks. And really, that's what I believe we find in science, that science actually speaks to us and tells us the glory of God. The psalmist is saying, if we look at the world around us, which is what science is concerned with, it will tell us about our Creator. In Romans chapter 1, Paul makes the same argument when he talks about why people who have never received God's special revelation, the Bible, are still without excuse before God someday when they face Him in judgment. And he said in Romans chapter 1, beginning at verse 18, "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse." That's quite a claim that Paul makes. He's essentially saying that you don't have to have the Bible, that you don't have to have heard about Jesus in order for you to recognize wherever you are in the world, no matter what you've been taught about religion and spirituality and how the world got here, that you can reject all of that as falsehood simply based on looking at nature. Simply based on God's creation, we can say, you know what? No, God isn't like the gods that we find in Hinduism. God isn't like the pagan gods of the Greeks and the Romans from centuries ago. God isn't the God of Buddhism, who doesn't really exist, of course, in Buddhism. God isn't what we see in Islam. No, God is something different than that. And it will take us on a search. And as people search, and this has happened over and over again, people who are searching for the truth, God shows Himself. Even today, over in Ethiopia and the other nations in northern Africa, where people so often don't have any access to the gospel, there are people who say, God, show me what is the truth. And they're followers of Islam, they're Muslims, who believe in a prophet named Isa, who we call Jesus. But they think he's only a prophet. And God appears to them in visions and dreams and shows himself to them. And they turn to Christ. Why? Because they were truly, earnestly seeking after the truth. And God showed them himself. And that's essentially what Paul is saying here in Romans, is that if we're really seeking after the truth, creation itself will speak to us of God. And yet today, every day, we are inundated with claims to the contrary. Whether science is a hobby or maybe even your profession or not, our television, our newspapers, the internet are full of stories coming up all the time that take certain scientific ideas for granted that would seem to be contradictory to faith. For instance, that the universe, the solar system, and the earth are all billions of years old. That there has been life on earth for millions of years and humans for at least the last 50 to 100,000 years. That life was not created but spontaneously happened out of chemicals mixing in some sort of primordial soup, becoming single-celled bacteria. And then this life gradually evolved to the wide diversity of forms that we find today. And in a sense, the underlying message of all of these things is that therefore nothing exists for a purpose or was designed by an outside intelligence. Now, of course, these ideas all directly contradict what the Bible teaches about us about God, humans, and the earth. And I would not be the first to observe that the Bible is not a science textbook. God did not say, well, look at these humans. They just understand so little about all that I've created. So I'm going to create a book for them to understand how plants and animals came to be. That wasn't what the Bible was put there for. The Bible was put there for us to know that a God exists, that he loves us, that we are broken, and that he came to provide the solution to that. That's the big overarching story of the Bible. And along the way, God communicates things about creation. And we should expect that those things would be true. But he also used people like you and me who have limited understanding. And he used their expressions and he used even our understanding. You know, today, a lot of us would talk about the fact that the sun rose this morning. And yet, hopefully all 180 of us here don't believe that the sun rose, but that the earth rotated. And so sometimes we say things, we have expressions that may not be scientifically accurate. And sometimes the Bible even uses some of those expressions, like the sun rising. But we should expect that when the Bible speaks about what God did and what creation is like, that it should be reasonable, that it should be understandable. And I believe that that's what we actually do find in the Bible. We find in the Bible that the Bible explains that God created everything and that he did it in an orderly way. And that's really what the first chapter of Genesis and the third chapter of Genesis are talking about. They're showing that God, because the idea of the time was that kind of there was all this chaos, and just order and chaos were fighting with each other, and that was kind of a very common idea in religion at that time. And so in a sense, what God was trying to explain to those people is, no, that God came and He said, he spoke, and there was order, there was creation happening. And so as we look at what the Bible has to say in Psalm 19 and Romans chapter 1, we understand that what the Bible is saying is, as we look at creation, we should expect to understand a creator and things about our Creator, that He is a God of order. God could hold everything and do everything for us by magic 100% of the time. But instead, God was the kind of God who said, no, I'll create laws of physics and motion, and I'll create gravity, and I'll create all these things so that everything works. Of course, in recent years, not only have ideas contrary to the Bible been stated to be proven fact, but more and more we're told that to be a true scientist or even an intelligent person, we cannot possibly believe in God. Or that science and religion deal with different subjects and have nothing to say about each other. And they call this noma, non-overlapping magisteria. And it basically means religion and science, it's just like apples and oranges. They don't talk about even the same things. But of course, that isn't true. The Bible talks about the world and that we can see God from the world. And of course, it wasn't always this way. For hundreds of years, science developed in a Christian environment, with scientists assuming that God had made everything that they could see. Some atheists, in fact, today would say that Christians would be very poor scientists because they'd just say, well, God must have done it all the time. And yet, that's not what we find in scientists who are Christians. In fact, history shows us scientists who are Christians, they saw themselves like little children taking apart a toy that their parent had given to them. Any of you that kind of child? That you had to take it all apart and figure out how it worked? I was sometimes one of those. And then you can't get it back together. It takes you forever. Or maybe you have to go to your dad or your mom and say, do you have an instruction manual? History shows us that that's kind of what Christian scientists were like. They were like, God, you know, we understand that you made things with order. We want to see even more of your glory in what you've made. Help us to understand this. They felt that the Bible revealed this to them, that God had created order, and that they should therefore find it. And you know, this wasn't always something that was thought. In fact, in the days of Aristotle and Socrates, the philosophers, they thought that you just kind of, you know, logic would dictate everything. But they didn't care too much about observation. And it was a Christian, Francis Bacon, who first developed this scientific method based on looking at empirical observation. Johann Kepler, the founder of physical astronomy, maintained that studying the world and its process is really thinking God's thoughts after Him, discovering what it was like. People like Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, and Sir Isaac Newton were people who believed that the God of the Bible had created everything. Did you know that Sir Isaac Newton wrote more about theology than he did about science? Now, some of his theology wasn't that great, necessarily. But he believed that Jesus died and rose again, that God created everything that is. Kepler, who postulated that planetary orbits were elliptical, also incorporated religious arguments and reasoning into his work, motivated by the religious conviction and belief that God had created the world according to an intelligible plan, and that it would be accessible through the natural light of observation and reason. Galileo, who many people point out as being persecuted by the church, even though it was really his ridicule of the Pope that landed him in the most trouble, believed that God had created the universe to speak in the language of mathematics. So when we think about all of this, we need to ask ourselves, well, what is science? Why did these people believe that science and Christianity fit so well together, and now we have people today who say, no, no, they're totally separate? Science has been defined as simply as the search for truth about reality, or as complicated as the Oxford English Dictionary, where it defines it as a branch of study which is concerned either with a connected body of demonstrated truths or with observed facts systematically classified and more or less collocated by being brought under general laws, and which includes trustworthy methods for the discovery of new truth within its own domain. Everybody understand that one? There's a lot to unpack, and I'm not going to unpack it in there, but if I think we could boil it down to science is the search for systematic truth about reality. And if we understand that God is part of reality, then we will understand that sometime systems won't always be followed. That's what we call the supernatural. And there's lots of scientists today who get rid of that whole aspect. They want to just believe in the natural world, what they can see and feel. They're like Thomas, who said, I don't want to believe that Jesus could rise from the dead until I touch him, until I put my hand in his side, and I know he's not an imposter or something, but he's actually the Christ who I saw a spear put into his side. And yet, if we simply understand that God governs according to natural laws and that occasionally he does something supernatural and breaks in, then we can still follow science, we can still understand all of these things, and yet still pray and ask that God will do something supernatural in our lives, that he will provide, that he will show himself to be the real God who he claims to be, who cares about us. And I know if I asked each of you today to share about how God has shown himself real to you, that each of us would likely have something that we could share. And say, you know what? This is how God showed himself to be real. And what did he do? He did something, maybe even something small, but something that made you know what? I'm not alone. God is real, and he cares about me. What an awesome thing that is. And it's something that I think helps us so much when we're faced sometimes with some of these hard questions, because we know the truth. And so it's simply a matter of looking at the question from a different vantage point. And if supernatural events really do occur, then they are part of reality. And so the supernatural is something that, in a sense, we can try to look at a little bit from a scientific point of view. And yet it's going to be very difficult because science, as I mentioned earlier, it's concerned with systematic truth, with things that can be repeated, with experiments, things that can be explained as a system. And so there are many things that we cannot study. For instance, I have personally seen people healed. I had a friend as a teenager who had curvature of the spine, and he was about my height. And we went to youth camp. I met him at youth camp. And some other youth prayed for him for healing that night at the service. And he walked out of that service several inches taller than me. And so, you know, like that's supernatural. And you're not after the fact. I mean, you can look at an x-ray of his spine before and after, but you're not going to find out how that happened. You can't do anything because it was a miracle. And so science, the science of x-ray, can show us, okay, yes, a change happened, and we don't understand that. But if someone doesn't want to believe in God, they will come up with an explanation for how that must have happened. Maybe he got shocked electrically or something. Of course, we know he didn't. So when an atheist claims that you can't be a Christian and a scientist, we have to understand that what they're really doing is bullying. They're engaging in a grown-up form of bullying, playing the game that you probably saw hundreds of times on a playground growing up. When someone set the rules for who would be included in their special club, do you remember that? None of you had those kind of friends? It's just me and one other person often, you know, is how it starts, right? And, oh, okay, we'll let you in, and then you in. And everybody else, you're not part of our special club, right? And so they want to change the definitions of science. They want to change the definitions of reality, in a sense, to exclude everyone who doesn't agree with them. But we have to look at the rules of the club and say, are those reasonable? And we need to remind ourselves that we have a lot of good company, even today. And so if you look up there, I know you can't read them, but that's just a list of scientists who are alive today, who are published, who are professors in universities. They have their doctorates, and they accept not just that God exists, but these are people who actually support what we would call young earth creationism. So people who think that the earth has not been around for millions of years. And so we need to remind ourselves that people who have studied and studied science today, who are working in their fields, that they also believe in the supernatural, that they believe in the same God that we believe in. And so when someone says that science and religion are separate subjects and don't have anything to say about another, they're essentially doing the same thing. They're redefining what science is all about. And in fact, I'll talk a little bit later about how that is part of the deception that they're very aware of. But if science is truly about discovering the truth about reality, then Christianity actually has a lot to offer. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. If that's true, then everybody who's a true scientist should end up finding Jesus. If we're willing to throw out our preconceived notions and simply say, God, show me who you are. If you exist, there's people who've done that, you know. Some of our greatest apologetics masters, you could say, people who are always arguing for the faith today. I think of Josh McDowell, who started out as an atheist in university and was determined to prove some Christians wrong. But he was open to look for the truth. And as he did, God showed himself. And that happens again and again, that as people truly open themselves and say, okay, wherever the truth leads, that's where I'll go, they end up finding Jesus. In John 16, Jesus said, I have much more to say to you, more than you can now bear. But when he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you into all truth. Many of you have probably heard of George Washington Carver, the scientist who found hundreds of uses for peanuts, soybeans, sweet potatoes, and other plants to help poor farmers when cotton was failing, the cotton crops in the South. George Washington Carver is famous as a scientist, but what often people don't know is that he said, all of my life, I have risen regularly at 4 o'clock and have gone into the woods and talked with God. Then he gives me my orders for the day. When people are still asleep, I hear God best and learn my plan. Faith was not peripheral to his work. In fact, he asked God to guide his observations and to give him ideas, and he gave God credit. He said, I'm no smarter than any of these other scientists who are all trying to look for different functions of plants too, but somehow God just inspires my creativity. And you know, I know a computer scientist who is like this too. He has many patents to his name, and he told me, you know, every day, Jay, when I go to work, I start the work off and simply say, God, help me. I don't have what it takes to create some new idea that'll be patented. God, will you show me something new today about computers and electronics and switching, because he's a switching expert. And he says, you know, Lord, will you show me these things? And God has shown him. And he's ended up with patents to his name. And you know, whether you're a scientist or whatever you do in your work, I hope that you're doing that. You're saying, Lord, help me. Help me to understand what it is. Maybe you're even at home. You're not working right now. God has a purpose and a plan for this day, for tomorrow, and the day after. And we need to be asking and saying, God, what is your plan for me? I talked earlier about how some of these bullies, in a sense, say, you know, well, science and religion, they're completely opposite things. And some of you may have heard that in a science class here in Quebec or wherever you grew up. And I was very interested to read this blog by a biology teacher, high school biology teacher, and he said, you know, you can't bludgeon kids with the truth. You know, insult their religion, their parents, and their friends, and hope that they'll smile and believe you. Yes, Noma, non-overlapping magisteria, teaching that science and religion don't have anything to say about each other. Yes, that's wrong, he says, but it's a good first tool for gaining trust. You have to bring them over to your side, gain their trust, and then hold their hands and help them step by step. And on that slow journey, which will be painful for many of them, it's okay to use some inaccuracies temporarily, in other words, to lie, if they help you reach your students. And if students like the one that I quoted go on to study biology, then he or she will unlearn the inaccuracies in time. And if most of the students do not, but those cutesy examples help them accept evolution, then it's okay to accept the little inaccuracies for the rest of their lives. It's perfectly fine if they think that Mickey Mouse evolved, as long as they think evolution is fine and dandy overall. Without belief in non-overlapping magisteria, they would have never accepted anything, and well, so be it. Better Noma believers than creationists, don't you think? Proverbs 14:15 says, fools will believe anything, but the wise think about what they do. And that's what we're doing today. I know that some of you hated science in school, and you're saying, Pastor Jay, can you get on with it? This isn't my thing. But you know, you have friends, you have fellow students, you have people you run into every day who are caught by some of the lies that they were told. And some of the teachers themselves don't even realize that they're lies because they're just teaching whatever's in the textbook. And so we have to grapple with some of these things, even if it's not your favorite subject. We have to understand the worldview of where people are coming from. Scientific historian William Provine writes, let me summarize my views on what modern evolutionary biology tells us loud and clear. There are no gods, no purposes, no goal-directed forces of any kind. There is no life after death. When I die, I am absolutely certain that I'm going to be dead. That's the end for me. There is no ultimate foundation for ethics, no ultimate meaning to life, and no free will for humans either. That's the natural result of evolutionary thinking, which is a certain branch of science. Belief in modern evolution makes atheists of people, he says. One can have a religious view that is compatible with evolution only if the religious view is indistinguishable from atheism. So in other words, he's claiming that Christians who say they believe in evolution, that really the only way that can be true is if they make out God to not actually exist. They may give lip service to it, but practically speaking. And you know, that can be true of us sometimes. Sometimes we say we believe in Jesus. We say that God can do anything, but then we go about our lives as though he can do nothing. Any ouches this morning? If we're not praying on a daily basis, it's because we think we can do okay on our own. And so sometimes we theoretically believe the right things, but we're practically living out the wrong thing. And so we have to ask ourselves, what kind of God do we believe in? Because science, as scientists would have it today, in a certain branches, would tell us really that God doesn't exist. All those claims that William Provine made, if they're true, and we start believing them as Christians, then it's going to be deadly to our faith. And that's why I want us to take a moment to consider evolution today, because it is one of the aspects of primary attack on our faith today. And it's very interesting, you know, you can become a scientist in almost all areas of science today without actually learning very much about evolution. And it's amazing how many scientists in different branches accept evolution just because they figure, well, some scientist somewhere has figured this out. And so I respect their work and I'll agree with what it says. But when they actually start looking at things, when they start realizing what biological evolutionary scientists are claiming, then they start to realize, well, that isn't like any other branch of science. That doesn't make sense. Evolutionary theory doesn't actually help us in most branches of science. And some, maybe even using the term evolutionary science is a little bit misleading, because really the theory of evolution is a historical claim. So it's saying that something happened in the past, which is not normally what science is about. Normally science is about looking at what currently is. And yes, we make some predictions maybe on what has happened in the past based on that, but we can't really say in the year 774 something happened based on science. We can look at certain things and say we think that those are historical records. And so we think that something happened maybe around a certain year. But really that's not a scientific claim. And individual claims about the ages of things, while they can be claimed scientifically, when we try to duplicate what happens, we should expect in science, if you do an experiment and you do it twice, you should get the same results or else there's something wrong. Well, we don't find that kind of accuracy when people start getting into evolutionary theory. And so I want to look at just a few important beliefs to do with evolution. First, evolution believes that life came from spontaneous mixing of chemicals. Darwin referred to the primordial soup where life began, and scientists guessed that there was kind of this soup. And for many years they thought, well, maybe a lightning strike or something happened that just caused a whole bunch of these chemicals to combine, and now we had life. The problem with that theory is that even when scientists are trying, even when they put together all sorts of chemicals and then zap it with electricity and try different temperatures and different conditions and different atmospheres, that with all the experiments that they've tried, they can't make life appear. Sometimes they can make certain factors of life, like insulin, maybe appear for a fraction of a second, but then it dissolves again. And they have no mechanism for explaining how life came to exist, how a cell could come into existence and guard the contents so that they wouldn't just dissolve again. And that's why so many creation scientists are biochemists and mathematicians. Because you see, biochemists look at the chemistry side of things, and mathematicians understand odds. And both of these professions see that it's impossible for life to come about by a chance combination of inorganic, non-living chemicals. When Darwin wrote his theory, cells were considered to be simple blobs. But biochemists have been learning for decades now that they are in fact complicated factories, far more complicated than Bombardier's factories that are closing down. Well, I guess they're keeping going under Airbus, aren't they? But you have millions of cells in your body, and every single one of them is a little factory. And it is producing various things and multiplying and as it dies, creating other cells to replace it. We're immensely complicated. And many of these machines are irreducibly complex, which means that if you take out one part, the whole thing doesn't work. And so when we look at these kind of systems, we have to ask, well, how did all of those parts get there? If you have any four out of these five parts, nothing happens. And so evolution would assume, well, you add one part at a time. But what? How in the world would we add, just by chance, a whole bunch of these things, one after the other, and they just all happened, even though it's not working, and now we expect suddenly that it's going to work when the fifth part comes in, or the thousandth part in some cases? Mathematicians can calculate the statistical odds of these kind of events occurring. Isaac Asimov, who's famous for his fictional writing but was also a mathematician, calculated the possible combinations of 30 amino acids in a single insulin protein molecule as 8 times 10 to the 27th power. If you can see the zeros there, that's 8 times 10 to the 27th power. And he's saying only one chance out of all of that would insulin be the spontaneous result of all of the necessary building blocks coming together. It gets much more complicated than that when we look at even the DNA of the smallest known virus. That is 1 in 1 times 10 to the 1,506th power, which should be on the next slide. Let me just tell you, you have greater odds of winning the lottery 5 days in a row than you have of the DNA for that single virus spontaneously resulting. And so mathematicians understand that when you bring probability that low, there comes a point where it's not just 0.00000000001 chance that DNA would spontaneously just kind of come together, but it's actually zero. Mathematicians call that where something approaches zero, and they really mean it's zero. There is no possibility, because even if it occurred, it would be destroyed in the next second after. Because we'd need all of these things to happen. To have one cell, you'd need the DNA, and you'd need all of these mechanisms to all come together at one time. This is why I would consider this one of the strongest objections to evolution and to this whole conception of life coming by chance. Dr. Francis Crick, co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, found the origin of life problems so difficult that he suggested that life was likely sent here by aliens from another world. Well, that just removes the problem to a different location, one that we can't observe. Is that what science is about? Maybe somehow life stuck to an asteroid and the asteroid crashed on Earth, and somehow in all that heat that would normally burn up any sort of life, somehow we're supposed to expect that life survived that. And then the other suggestion that scientists give us. Well, life exists, so it must have happened. You can say the probability is astronomically low, it couldn't have happened, but, well, it happened. They do the same sort of things that they say that Christians do. Oh, well, we'll just say it's God and not investigate any further. Oh, well, life is here, so I guess it happened by chance. The irony of this is that before modern science came, people believed that maggots just came spontaneously generated from meat, and frogs spontaneously generated from mud. That life was spontaneously generated from dead things, and it was early scientists who showed them that life came from life, that we actually have reproduction, and that the maggots were actually coming from little eggs and those kinds of things. And now it's scientists who want to take us back and say, no, it's just like this soup of chemicals, and somehow life just pops out of it. when I was in OIC biology, sorry, that's like grade 13 in Ontario, I put a diagram up on the board during one of my presentations and said, you know, a frog turns into a prince. Time equals instantaneous. That's a fairy tale. A frog turns into a prince. Time equals millions of years. That's science. And I know that I'm making a little bit of fun of some of those scientists in a sense today. But we have to understand that just adding more time doesn't help. In fact, it would require far too much time. If God even just made the first living cell and then left it to evolve, we don't have enough time for everything that we see in the time that the scientists would say that the Earth has been around 4.5 billion years and that these fossils have to be hundreds of millions of years old. They're trying to add time saying, well, if you just give it enough time, anything can happen. When in fact, what we tend to find over time is that things become extinct, things get worse. We find that there's genetic deterioration, not increases in things getting better. And the problem really is that scientists' dating methods don't work. They'll talk today, and if you read articles, they'll talk about carbon-14 dating. They'll talk about dating of rocks, which of course doesn't involve carbon-14, but other elements like argon. And the idea of radioactive dating is great, unlike Tinder dating. You have two radioactive atoms. Sorry, I just had to throw that in because you're looking all so serious, and I know that I'm over the head of some of you. But I want us to talk about this today because I think it's so important that we understand that there are reasonable answers to this. I love science. I love discovery. But we also have to look at things with a critical eye and say, why? What are the biases of the scientists who are writing this, or even of the reporters who are writing the articles that we're reading? And the idea of radioactive dating is great. You'd have two radioactive atoms, one of which is created when the other decays. And you measure how much you have of each one, and then you calculate the age of the rock. The problem is that there's a lot of guesswork involved. You have to guess how much of the material was there at first, originally, which they're thinking is millions of years ago. You have to assume that the decay rates have been stable for millions of years, even though scientists have shown that the decay rate actually changes with the seasons and with solar flares and those kinds of things. And you have to assume essentially that everything has stayed the same on the Earth for millions and millions of years, when in fact those same scientists would say that everything has changed on the Earth a whole lot in those millions and millions of years. The other thing that we can do is we can test dating methods against rocks that we have seen created. So scientists dated lava flows that were created in 1949, 1954, and 1975 in New Zealand. And they got dates that varied from 270,000 years to 3.5 million years. Now, I don't know if there's any scientists with us here today. If you were, yes, no, I don't see you here anyway. So, but if you're here and you're a scientist, imagine whether your workplace would accept that kind of a margin of error in any experiment that you do. Imagine any science where you could have a margin of error of 421,900% to 5,000,000%, and we'd call that science. Dating basalt from the base of the Grand Canyon, where lava had spilled over the edge, and so it was also on the floor of the Grand Canyon, so they knew it happened long after the Grand Canyon was formed, and yet when they dated the lava flow, they got a date 270 million years older than the rocks that it was flowing over top of, the bedrock at the bottom of the canyon. And when they were dating that rock thought to be only thousands of years old. They got dates, they used different elements, different radioactive elements, three of them. Three different methods came up with ages ranging from 10,000 years old to 2,600 million years, in other words, 2.6 billion years old, for a lava flow that's on top of the Grand Canyon. And if we generously use the oldest date of the one type, then we're still getting 1,100% to 2,200% ranges of error. And so we just have to ask ourselves, why? Why would we accept this as science? Because there's an agenda. There's a bias. And in fact, you'll find that scientists, they look at rocks and they see certain fossils in them, and they'll say, well, that rock must be this old because it has that kind of fossil in it. And so therefore, we can take our study of how to date rocks, and we can date the, we can calibrate the study based on the date of these fossils. And then somewhere else, someone will take that same test that was calibrated based on the fossil, and they'll say, well, we can say that these fossils are this old because this rock is this old. It's called circular reasoning, where you just trade, you know, okay, so this geologist and this archaeologist or whatever, they trade information as though your stuff is valid, so therefore my stuff is valid. Oh, and your stuff is valid, so therefore my stuff is valid. Not recognizing that they're both depending on each other, and there's nothing objective about it. The third thing that I want us to consider, not just the dating, and I know that I'm kind of skimming over these fairly quickly, is the fine-tuning for life on Earth. Because evolutionists often say that they expect that life has evolved in many other places in the universe. And in fact, there's SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, that has operated for many years trying to find other Earth-like planets. And every so many years, you'll find that they'll have a new article, if you follow science articles, where they say, scientists have discovered a planet that may be a greenhouse, you know, it might be like Earth, and it's so exciting, well, we'll probably find life. And then a little while later, it's like, well, no, actually. And you see, when scientists first began studying all of this, they assumed that there would be thousands and thousands of planets like Earth all over the universe. And yet, the more powerful telescopes they get, the more they find that there's nothing out there. That there's no planets that could possibly sustain life. And of course, it's not surprising, because when we look at the fine-tuning of the Earth for life, there are things that, once again, couldn't just happen by chance. Creation depends on so many delicate balances, and life support here on Earth is so fragile. Of course, that's what we're talking about even when people talk about climate change today. They think that just raising by a couple of degrees Celsius will be a crisis of unimaginable proportions. And yet they want to say, well, all these worlds all over the place probably have life too. Let's just consider a few of the things about the Earth today. The rotation of the Earth. Our globe spins on its axis at a rate of 1,000 miles per hour, meaning that it once every 24 hours, it comes around so that we are exposed to the sun. If it spun faster, the atmosphere would become oppressively dense, and there would be daily earthquakes and volcanic explosions. If it were much slower, then our days and nights would be far too long. And you think it's freezing today? Try a, you know, 72-hour night where no heat from the sun would come. If that happened regularly, we'd all be in trouble. And of course, a 72-hour day in the summer would mean that the earth would heat up so dramatically, and vegetation would be starved of moisture. It would be burnt up. Consider the heat of the sun. Our sun is a yellow dwarf star. If it were just a little bit bigger, we'd all be fried. If it were a little smaller, we'd all freeze to death. And the same goes for if we were just 5% closer to the sun or 5% further away. Consider the size of the earth. If it were much smaller, it wouldn't have held an atmosphere. If it were a little larger, the atmosphere would be too dense and gravity too powerful, and it would flatten the earth, and we would become more like Jupiter or Neptune, where they're kind of gas or water worlds. Consider the tilt of the earth's axis. If it was not tilted, the vapors from the oceans would ice over the continents, and there'd be no life. Consider the moon. If it were much closer, every day giant tides would inundate every bit of landmass on the earth, and the moon would eventually spiral in and wipe us out. If it were much further away, it would be released from orbit, and the earth's axis would destabilize and swing over a large range, possibly resulting in one of the poles being pointed at the sun and us suddenly having an endless day on one side and endless night on the other. This also applies if the moon was much smaller, like the ones that are around Mars. Consider the fact that our planet has large planets further out, whose huge gravity acts like a vacuum cleaner out in space to protect us from being bombarded by asteroids, and yet they have circular orbits so that they don't pull us too far from the sun. I've used these particular examples today because these are things that cannot happen by chance. And they cannot happen by some sort of living process like evolutionists. They can't evolve. The earth can't suddenly just start to creep out a little further and in a little further to get into the right spot. Somebody has to do that. And we know who that somebody is. I wish I had time today to talk about so many other things, like scientists who claim that there's dark matter, which means matter that doesn't exist, or dark energy that takes up 80 to 95% of the universe, or dinosaur bones that have soft tissue in them after millions of years, or the fact that people have known what dinosaurs looked like for hundreds of years and have drawn them in cave drawings and put up pictures. And I think we've missed a few pictures there because I'm moving so fast. But there's so many things that bolster our faith, that help us to understand that, you know what, people want there to be millions of years. They want there to be billions of years. Why? Because they don't want there to be a God. And that's what it really comes down to. And so as Christians, we have to know how to respond. We have to not be shaken in our faith, whether we're young or we're old, when science comes out with the latest reason not to believe in God. We need to recognize the bias. And we need to ourselves look at all the data sometimes. If we're feeling shaky in our faith, and I know that there's various times, I mean, I love reading all these things, and sometimes I read something and think, wow, that would be a real, you know, real challenge to you know, how can we work that out with the Bible? And then you go and you read the study and you realize that it doesn't say what they're saying it says. But this is just some reporter's interpretation of a certain data, and they don't know what they're talking about. So often that is the case. Even sometimes when scientists are saying it, they say, well, maybe and if and whatever, and then someone deletes all the maybes and the ifs. And so we as Christians need to know that we know that we know that God exists, that He is living and active in our lives. If you don't know that, then you are really at the mercy of an argument. But someone has said before, no one who has an experience is at the mercy of someone with an argument. If we know that God exists, nobody can tell us. And that's part of the reason why we're seeking more of the Holy Spirit. You know, sometimes Christianity can become dry, dead facts. We need the Spirit. We need a living relationship with God. That's what helps us to know that God is alive and well and doing what He's doing in the world and calling us and giving us purpose. And that's why I'm sharing all of this with you today, because I don't want us to be shaken in our faith. I want us to move forward. I want us to feel confident that we can engage non-Christians, atheists even, and say, you know what? I know that there's an answer for that question. I don't know the answer to every question, but I know there is an answer. Why? Because I know that God exists. I know that He's alive and real and living inside me. And He's called me to love you. You know, sometimes we get in those harsh arguments with other people, but God called us to love them. And so I believe that that's what God wants us to do. Yes, sometimes we need to engage the atheists and argue some of those points. And sometimes we need to say, you know what, I don't know, but I'm going to find out and I'll come back. But when we do, we need to always be doing it in a spirit of love. Like Jesus, as He engaged the people who are against Him. Sometimes He said harsh things, and yet we also know that Jesus said He looked at the people and said that they were like sheep without a shepherd. They were confused. They were blind to the truth. And that's how we need to see people and understand that God has called us to be the light and to draw people to the truth. We don't have to convince people of Jesus. We just have to show them Jesus, ultimately. And God will help. God, the Holy Spirit, is the one that does the convincing. And we just do our part, what God is calling us to do, and stand for what we believe in. As the worship team comes this morning, I realize that my sermon today has been a little different than some. It's not so much one that necessarily will challenge you in the sense of you saying, you know what, I need to grow here, I need to change there. Maybe it does. Maybe it's you'd say, you know what, I've been a bit lazy about my thinking. I need to investigate more of God's creation. Or I need to find out, maybe I've been actually giving in to some of those arguments and believing, you know, what some of the people say who don't want there to be a God. And I really believe that the Holy Spirit could be speaking to you on those things today. And if that's you, I'd love to talk with you more after, to pray with you, to help you in any way that I can. And I'd encourage you to talk with other people. Sometimes when we keep our worries inside, you know, our doubts can grow. But when we share them and find answers, we can be so encouraged and end up encouraging others and strengthening others in their faith. And so I'm not sure what the Spirit has been saying to you today, but maybe He's just been saying, you know what? We need to not be timid. We need to stand for the truth. And this is the truth, that God created us, that we made a mess of it, and He sent His Son to make things right. And we need to tell that to every person that we possibly can, in as winning a way as we possibly can. So God, help us. Help us in all these questions that people have. Maybe the Spirit, maybe you know all this. Maybe you've been trying to do all of this. And today, God just wants to remind you of how great He is, how awesome it is that He's done so much to help make our planet a place that we can live in. And we need to be good stewards of that, of course, but we can also just glorify and praise Him. And the worship team is going to lead us today in a song that simply does that, that simply says, God, You are awesome for all that You have created. And I want to invite you today simply to respond as the Holy Spirit has been directing you. Maybe to simply say, yeah, God, You're awesome. Look at all You've created. Maybe to say, God, yes, would you move in my heart? Would You help me to deal with the doubts that I'm facing in a way that leads to truth? Lord, You are an awesome God. When we consider the works of Your hands, what an awesome Creator You are. When we consider how safe You have kept us with things we didn't even know about, and yet You put them in place so that we could live and discover more of who You are. God, You not only created us, but You've come to live with us and in us. We can never thank You enough. Lord, I pray, even as today's message has in some ways been technical, Lord, that your Holy Spirit would help us to apply the truth. Lord, that we would not be shaken in our faith as people with various agendas and biases and different understandings come and try to attack our belief in you. But God, that we would be able to stand solidly on the truth, to recognize who you are. And even more than that, not just to hold on to our own faith, but God, that you would give us the wisdom and the words and the behavior that show people that you are real, that you love them, that you are powerful, that you are active today, that you are the same God today that you were 2,000 years ago when you walked the earth healing people and showing them the way, the truth, and the life, that you're still doing that today. Oh God, help us as your people in a society that is full of so much hopelessness and darkness because they've accepted the lie that you're dead, that you never existed. Lord, help us to bring the light where you're calling us to bring the light into our schools and workplaces and even our own homes in some cases. Lord, give us boldness and confidence by your Spirit to say wherever we go, God, you reign. Jesus, you are the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and I'm here to serve you and honor you with my life. Oh God, may that be something that we can honestly proclaim wherever we go and whenever in our lifetime. Oh God, help us, strengthen us, use us to encourage and strengthen one another. In your name we pray. Amen.